Hi, folks. Jack Spirko here. Today you are listening to an episode of TSP Rewind. Commercial-free versions of past episodes. Podcast blasts from the past. I put these up when I can't do a show due to professional commitments or rare vacations. These podcasts will appear in standard iTunes, Stitcher, and other feeds, but will be titled TSP Rewind episodes and numbered accordingly. And today we are rewinding back to March the 20th, 2018. And just a couple days shy of what there, 6 years ago. This was originally called Homesteading, Side Hustles, and More, and was originally episode 2186 of the Survival Podcast. Now, you might be wondering why on a, you know, like usually when there's a rewind, it's one of two things have happened. Something's gone wrong in the Spirko Farmstead household, etc., and we have to go do something. Or it was planned in advance and pre-announced, so you might be thinking something's really wrong. It's not really wrong. Here's what's going on today. I just have some accounting stuff that I have to get caught up on because we're coming up on tax deadline. That's all there is to it. And this weekend wasn't good. We did some stuff for my wife's birthday and all. And, you know, what's the point of running your own business if you can't make adjustments like that and put family first? So that's what I did, and that's why I've got to take today to do very unproductive work. And this unproductive work is because, well, we have to pay upgrade his tribute, right? The head pimp in charge, Ira Ramon Sancia, the IRS. And just on this, because it irritates me to have to do it and be non-productive, I just thought I would throw out, how much non-productivity is there in our country due to the need to justify how much we pay in taxes to the government and how much we don't pay? You know, I always say that 90% of the tax code isn't what you have to do. That's only 10%. The other 90% is how you get out of it. But there's a hell of a lot of work that goes into getting out of it. And it just seems like there probably is a better way. But it's better than the alternative. Because what is the alternative? The alternative is all of your income is on a W-2 or something that your broker sends you about capital gains. That's all you get. And you go put it in there and you take the few measly deductions they let you have. And then they take a huge portion of your life force away. So having a business is a great way to go, whether it be a above board business or a gray market business, something that might be a side hustle on your homestead. So in honor of that, I selected today's episode. Again, homesteading, side hustles, and more. And in this episode, it's really a twofer. We break it down into finding the right place to have a homestead. And then once you do, how do we take that new opportunity and on some level monetize it, you know? And this requires a mental shift. It requires a mental shift to think more like our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our great-great-grandparents. Just 100 years ago, the vast majority of people in our country made their living one way or another connected to farming and agriculture. And I mean the vast majority. And if we go back 150 years... It's a super majority, and not the way they use that term in government today either. I mean, it was, you either were in agriculture or you worked for somebody that was in agriculture, or you were in agriculture and worked for somebody in agriculture. But there was also something else that went with all of this. People would look and they had this plot of land. Whether it would be the person that today we would consider a city dweller who probably lived on a dirt road in a town with a house, with a yard that many people today would go gaga over because it's so large compared to what living in town means today. Or they were a person with 40 acres and a mule, or something a little bigger, or something in between. And they looked at this and they said to themselves, well, how do we make sure that this place that we have provides for us? This is the original home-to-homestead generation, right? And that's a theme that, you know, going back 16 years to the very beginning of the Survival Podcast, one of the first few months of doing the show, I don't remember what episode it was, but I did an episode called From Home to Homestead. And this is the mental shift that we need to make in this day and age so that we can prevent everything that we've worked for being taken from us. And that is that most Americans provide for their home. I didn't say provide for their family. I think you should provide for your family. I said they provide for their home. And what I mean by that is their home is expensive. And since they can't just whip out, you know, a billfold full of, you know, $1,000 bills like Scrooge McDuck and say, how much is this house? $350,000 and wallet and count, you know, $350,000 bills out and hand it over, they go to a bank and they get a mortgage. So now the $350,000 house over their lifetime costs over $1 million, and these are people that will never be millionaires. You see the problem there, don't you? 30 years, you're going to shell out $1 million, never be a millionaire. You'll have a house at some point that's worth $1 million, maybe, if property values keep going up. But if you sell it, all you can do is buy another one just like it or one far lesser than it. So what's the solution? We have to make the home a provider instead of a dependent. And that's what this episode, at least in part, is about. See, your grandfather or your great-grandfather or your great-great-grandfather, depending on your age, let's say they were the person with the 40 acres and a plow and a good plow horse. And they grew, let's say, corn, which was a very popular thing to grow for a farm that size back then. They still might set out another little plot, let's say a half acre to an acre. And that half acre to 1 acre would maybe grow tobacco, which they would dry and sell. Maybe they would keep some of it for personal use, but that's a lot of tobacco. And they would call that a money crop. And during the growing part of the season, most people that were full-time farmers that had enough land to support themselves and their families, they didn't just sit around and watch the corn grow. It's kind of boring, really. Whenever they had the time, they weren't fixing something that broke on the farm or whatever, they looked around and said, I'm a man, I can do things. Who near me needs a thing done that they can't do? And they would go out and they would take care of it. Given they took care of their own equipment, they were pretty good at taking care of equipment for the few real city dwellers out there. Maybe break out that spoke shave and fix up a wheel for somebody for their buggy. Or they would figure out that maybe they could rent a room out to somebody or put a little place in to rent out to somebody who was new to town and needed a place to stay and wasn't established yet. Or they would figure out, hey, if we put in an ice house and we go out and cut ice in the winter, we'll have ice, but we can also sell some of that ice to people that don't have one. In other words, our society was one of the most entrepreneurial societies that history has ever known. There's a lot of history that talks about the evils of unfettered capitalism of the time, but there's, for some striking reason, there's very little that talks about how everybody else was participating in it on one level or another. Gee, I wonder why that is. And because of this, the average American was far more secure 120 years ago than they are today, despite all the horror stories about how rough it was. And what I mean by that is because they had this variety of skills and this variety of income streams, they had designed their life, whether they knew it or not, in the form of a net versus a linear system that we're in today. In fact, they were taking a permaculture approach to lifestyle design. Now, if I throw a net into a lake to catch fish, and somebody walks in there and cuts 10 holes in my net, but it's a rather large net, and the holes are about the size of my hand. When I pull that net in, it is likely that some of the fish that I'd have caught will slip through the holes in the net. But I can then still get some fish, and I can eat and have some way to provide for myself and my family while I fix the holes that some jerk put in my net. But if my system is linear, I have a house that I pay for with a mortgage that I can only have because I have a job, and that's a straight line of connection, and it keeps going, and it's all the expenses in my life and all the burdens in my life, and if at any point one of those lines are cut, the whole thing falls apart. And this is why we have such high bankruptcy rates, such high suicide rates, and such high rates of clinical depression in this country. There's other reasons for it. They've jacked up our food supply. They have doped us up with some of the worst drugs ever created for mankind while claiming that they're going to have a war on drugs to prevent us from doing drugs that will ruin our lives. They're selling us drugs that in many ways are far worse than many of the drugs that are to this day in most places still illegal. What's the solution? The solution is back to what I said at the beginning of this new intro. It is reassessing your life and determining where is any place that I can plug into and create either a resource stream or an income stream, or both. What's a resource stream? A resource stream is, see that place over there that we were going to plant us a decorative tree? Plant a big old self-fertile apple tree. It'll grow up, and in a few years, some apples will come off it, in a few more years, even more, and at some point, lots of apples will come off it. Now that tree is a resource stream. Instead of being something that we have to feed, take care of, and water that provides us nothing but shade, apple trees provide shade, but they also provide food. If it produces enough apples, then maybe we can sell some, or barter some, or trade some, or just simply get goodwill with the neighbors from it, or make a product out of it that is value add. And then we have to start asking ourselves, how many resource streams and income streams can I plug into this little piece of property? This is resiliency. This is lifestyle design. This, if they gave one flippin' damn about you and your children, would be part of the terrible education system that we have. It would. You would teach this in school. You would teach children that, hey, one day you're going to grow up and be big boys and girls, and you're going to become adults, and you're going to buy a house, and you're going to live in a house. And when you live in that house, you're going to have additional resources. And you should be looking at those resources and thinking, what can this do for me? Instead, we train children to believe that if they don't owe money to somebody in this country, they're nobody. That debt is the way forward. And we condition and train them into a life of self-imposed slavery. To break free from slavery, one must figure out where the chain is. Where is the chain? If you're a conventional slave, old school style, your chain is the fact that literally sometimes there's physical chains that you can see, but people can't work real well in those. So there were guards. There were brands that they put on people. You couldn't work in society if anybody found out you were an escaped slave. You would have to escape far enough away where people saw it differently. But it was clear, wasn't it? My slavery chains are existing in this place under the control of these people, and to break those chains, I must get away from here. The chains are the fact that just because you're a slave doesn't mean you don't have kids and wives. And so the chains are also the things that hold me back. If I leave them behind, I won't see them, or will they be punished because I left? Those are your chains. In 2024, what is your primary chain? No, it's not the taxes that I bitched about in the beginning of this. No. And it's not a real chain. You don't look down at your hands and see chains on your hands or a big old ball attached to a chain to your right ankle. Those are not your chains. Your chains today are in your mind. Your belief in your limitation and their power is your chain. When we look at episodes like this one from 6 years ago, we start to realize that those chains are incredibly fragile. And if you've wondered why they freak out with such violent response to anybody that pushes back at all on any of their narratives, that's why. If the chains were strong, if the chains were secure, if the chains were unbreakable, they'd flaunt it. Tough slaves, we don't care. Get bent, get back out in the field and pick the metaphorical cotton and make sure you give your master his tribute of it. But no, they know that when you are using mental change, the illusion of control, that it's incredibly fragile, that one chink in the one link of the chain can cause a cascading effect. And sometimes that cascading effect can run away. When it's only one slave that runs away, you try to make an example out of them, but even if you can't, it's only one. It won't be long before the others are left behind, except that they too are slaves. And you might even lie to them and say, well, we found him and he won't be coming back because we made an example of him, even if he got away. But when the chains are mental, when is your mental sovereignty at stake, and you simply break free of it, and you live free, surrounded by other slaves who are like, wait a minute, how did he do this? It's very dangerous. Whether you speak up and say that a medication works, that the magical witch doctor said didn't, whether you point out that the media is lying again, it doesn't matter what it is. When you stand up in this world and speak against anything that the masters have decreed, their top slaves, their high-class slaves, will try to kill you. Not with knives and guns and clubs, but in the court of public opinion. And we should do it anyway. We should do it all the time. That's what this episode's really about. So let's go ahead and rewind back to March 20th, 2018, episode 2186, Homestead, Side Hustles, and More. And I want to just real quick throw out to you guys today, this is a non-commercial rewind type show, but I do want to encourage you to check out tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You can find all my reviews on products. And remember, we're now partners with Vivor. In addition to just the Amazon reviews that we have a few Vivor reviews out already. But you can check out the entire Vivor store. Just go to tspaz.com. It'll be the first link on that page. Lots of information there. Lots of reviews. But you can click that first link, get over to Vivor. Make sure you use my discount code that's right there with it, and it'll tell you what the code is. Use that code to get 5% off anything there, in addition to the already better pricing than you get buying Vivor through Amazon. There's some really cool stuff there. Check some stuff out, like hose reels. I'm going to review some soon, but there's some pretty cool ones, both for garden hoses and air hoses. That's just one example. Check out the garden beds that I've been recommending, etc. Start building up that homestead. Invest in yourself. Invest in your tools. Invest in your freedom. And support the show while you do it. With that, let's go ahead and rewind back. March 20th, 2018. Let's get into this. So, again, I went on Zillow today, and this was kind of the thing that came most to the surface that also had enough flesh in it. There are a few ideas that I might do some segments and some feedback shows on, but this one had enough flesh in it to make a full episode. So what we want to talk about today is homesteading from a standpoint of like finding the right homestead. Now, if I go completely in depth on that, that would be a whole episode. And then homesteading from a standpoint of actually having your homestead provide for you. And if I went really, really deep into that, that would be a whole episode. And homesteading from a side point of how do side hustles fit in and income off the profitability of the homestead fit in. But I thought, you know, if we go more at a high level with this and just some ideas and concepts that you can take and flesh out for yourself, we can actually do all of that in one episode. It sounds ambitious, but I'm not only going to do it for you, I'm still going to keep the show under 90 minutes, which is my primary objective this year, without letting the show get too long. So we'll see if we can do that. So I think what we should start out with is what actually makes a home into a homestead. And one of the most successful episodes I did back in the car days when I was used to do this show in my car during my 55-mile commute was an episode called From Home to Homestead. And I realized I haven't talked about that a lot recently, and we should, because it is a fundamental driving reality behind the message that we teach here. A home takes from you, a homestead provides for you. It is really kind of that simple. And what I mean is the average American thinks their home is their greatest asset, but generally they're up to their eyeballs in debt on it. They usually buy the most expensive home they can afford, and therefore there's nothing left in the budget to do other things smart. So they end up spending more money, not just in their mortgage. And then what they're worried about is property value, which we'll talk about today that's important too. But what I mean by that is they want the lawn, true green chem lawn. They want to fit into the HOA. They become members of, you know, the local golf club or whatever the hell it is. And they live the life that they think is the Beaver Cleaver, the Jordan, you know, June and Ward Cleaver life, which is nothing like the life that was the modern Beaver, you know, Leave It to Beaver life is a disaster. And that house is like a giant sponge that sucks up every extra penny that they would ever have, or creates a lifestyle that will do that where the house does not. So the house becomes a money sink. And, well, we got to keep up with the Joneses or the Smiths, whoever the hell they are. I don't give a shit who the Smiths and Joneses are, but most people do. So that starter home that was at the edge, when they get to a point where they realize they can sell it and harvest equity, then they move up, and they keep getting worse and worse and worse. That is the home of the modern American. The homestead is the place that we buy well within our means. We're smart about it. We look for places where we can improve it to increase its value. So instead of maintaining the property value through some facade, we are willing to take a diamond a little bit in the rough and polish it so that if we do want to leave, we have that exit strategy And that builds equity much more quickly. And since we can afford to pay for the home, we can afford to do that. We put in a little garden. Maybe we'll get some chickens. Some of the stuff we'll talk about today. But we start to live a little bit like our ancestors did, our great-grandparents. And then we start to actually have things get produced on our property that are provided to us, which prevents us from having to go off the property, which means spend money to acquire them. And that's the fundamental difference. And when we're looking for that, we need to define the fundamental characteristics of a good homestead location. Okay? And that can be difficult. And there was a lot of people today on Zello talking about, I really want out of this state. I really want out of this place. I want 50 acres. I want at least 5 acres. I want at least an acre. I mean, stuff like that. This community is full of that. And I don't blame you guys because I feel the same way. That's why I live on my little 3-acre place here near Azle, Texas. In an unincorporated area where nobody bothers me. That's the best thing about being here. It's a hard piece of land, but nobody bothers me. I can do whatever I want, and nobody bothers me. So my first fundamental consideration in choosing a homestead location is freedom. But it's freedom as you define it. So if some of the things that are important to me that I can do here are not important to you, and you and your family are happy with certain restrictions that are never going to bother you anyway, then you don't need to figure out what my version of freedom is. You need to figure out what your version of freedom is. But if you're going to move to a homestead and you have these dreams that you want to do with it, then you need a place that lets you exercise the freedom to make those dreams come true, to pursue that happiness. So that's my first consideration. My next consideration is climate, as you like it. I keep getting pressure, man, from the people up in New Hampshire. Why don't you come be part of Free State Project? Hey, your buddy Vin Armani's doing it. Yeah. Okay, it's freaking cold. I don't like it that cold. I actually love the place about 6 months out of the year. The rest of the year, I don't like it. It's too cold for me. And there's a lot more to climate than just the atmospheric climate. There's a climate of people. There's a climate of how happy are your family going to be. That's part of your internal climate. So you needed to figure out the place that gives you the right climate from the macro and the micro standpoint to exercise your freedom and find your full happiness. Then value. You need a piece of property that gives you the ability to say, this was a mistake, I want to leave, and cash out and get out. All solid investments have exit strategies. When we went into the first Gulf War, the second Gulf War, one of the things the left said, and they were right about, is what's the exit strategy if this doesn't pan out the way we think it's going to? We don't have an exit strategy. And you hear that in the news and the media often about conflict. What is the exit strategy? Totally legitimate question. Why do we only use it for geopolitical discourse where we, the people, don't really have much to say about whether it happens or not anyway, when we should be using it in our own lives? When I'm looking at a house to buy, I'm thinking to myself, what are two or three things that I know that I can do to this piece of property in the first year that a year from now, if something blows up in my world and I have to leave, I know that I can cash out and get out? Or I'm looking for a property that's so undervalued right now, the person's so desperate, that I could probably flip the property in 90 days doing almost nothing to it. I don't need to have to make a lot of money doing that. I just need to have the option. I'm not going to buy a property that I'm not going to be able to sell for at least what I owe on it very, very quickly after buying it. I want value. And the best value comes from the ability to increase value. It is much easier to find a property that's selling at market value for the way it is now, with easy, simple things that can be done to improve its value and improve your life while you're there to make your exit strategy even more sound. Especially if we do the improvements without debt. I don't even care if they're a wash. If we put $20,000 into a remodel, and when we sell the house, we get not a dime of profit on that 20 grand, but we didn't go into debt for that. We get the $20,000 back. Now I got cash. Now I can do something else with it. That's not ideal. That's my minimum threshold for, do I do something on this property? Will it give me the ability to extract the equity back out of it into the future? This is a business decision. Then there's the other side of it. Does it improve my life sufficiently that I'm willing to pay for some of that? especially if I think I found my forever place. The more I feel like I'm not leaving, the more I'm willing to realize, okay, I'm going to put 20 grand into this. It's going to add 15,000 to the price of the property. That's not great, but since I'm not going into debt, I'd still, if I exited, have the 15 grand. And if I'm here for 5 years, is this worth $1,000 a year for those 5 years for me to have this? Yes or no? And you make those pragmatic decisions that way. And value is huge on when you're figuring things out. Next, size. I want to say this very clear. Farms are not homesteads. And remember that an acre can wear your ass out. So many people think they need so much land to be able to do what they want. And so many people, I think, are running away in their mind with the concept, I want goats, I want cows, I want pigs, I want chickens. Look, if that's what you want and you build a life on that and it works for you, God bless you, I wish you well, and I hope you stay happy with it. However, I've seen so many people get in so far over their heads with that approach. And when we take, especially if you've never managed livestock before, you're going to have losses. You're going to have animals die. You're going to have time. It's going to take time, even when you think, I've got a perfect system figured out. I saw a guy on YouTube do it. It worked for him. Yeah, he didn't show you all the things that broke. Okay? So you get that one or two animals, and one's better, and you build a system around that. And then when that system's really rocking and it doesn't take a lot of work anymore, then we consider another one. If you take that approach, you're going to find that you're probably not going to end up with 20 goats and 15 pigs and 100 chickens. And if you did that, you have a farm. And that's okay. And farms can be small, but in general, farms are larger pieces of land than homesteads. And to me, if you can get 100 acres, do it. And if I had 100 acres that I was starting out on right now, I would probably focus for the first 2 or 3 years on 1 to 2 acres maximum. I have 3, and I did too much here. I got excited, like everybody else does. And I'm telling you, this year I've pulled back, and I'm working on about 1 solid acre. And all of the things I've done for the years are really paying off, man. And it's incredible. It's incredible what's happening this year. And it is a direct result of not only making a decision on the ducks that they're really not right for this system at this time in its evolution anymore, that it's not right in our lifestyle anymore, but it's also in actually making the decision to pare down and focus on this small area last year. And all that work I did last year now is paying off this year. And it's much easier to maintain about an acre of a homestead. And you could do almost anything you would ever want to do. So the reason I'm saying this is, a lot of times when people start saying, well, can I make this lifestyle change and live this life? And they end up with this budget that they think they have to meet, that they go, I just can't. I can't afford $500,000 to buy a place. Yeah, you probably can't. But do you need to? So really think about that size and how much do you really need to do the things that you really want to do. And hopefully as we go through today, you'll realize that maybe you don't want to do as much as you think you want to do. Okay? Remember to look at all property through the permaculture lens. When I look at a property, the first things I say to myself, water access structure. Where's water on the property? Where can water be on the property? How do I get water to those places on the property? Water's first. The smaller the land is, that's the less dams and ponds we can do, but the easier to distribute water from the well or from the city or wherever you're getting it from, or from rain catch or what have you. All right? The next is access. How can I get to all the spots on this property, and how do I make sure that anything that I design in, I don't design out access? And structure. What are the structures on this property? That's the primary value. Where can other structures go, and how do they fit in with the access and the water? If you'll remember that when you evaluate property alone, you'll do a much better job of evaluating property when you're looking at it as a homestead. And people say, well, that applies to like the big farms or at least, you know, a few acre farmstead or whatever. No, that can apply to, hey, we've made a decision that we can actually make it go on a half acre in kind of a suburban, urban type, you know, small scale thing. You look at that property, water access structure, exactly the same way. Well, there's enough solar exposure there that I could put my greenhouse back there. That would be a structure. How am I going to get to that greenhouse? Well, there'll be a path here. That's access. Well, that structure represents an opportunity to capture water. We can put rain catch on there. How does the land flow, and how can we move the water across the land off of the structure that is the home, the structure that is any hard, you know, hard-packed area, and the structure that is now the greenhouse, which also harvests water. We can look at any size property through that lens of water access structure, and we should. The next, neighbors. Will they be a bother? Can they be? And see item one. Item one was freedom as you define it. So here's what I mean. If you have pain in the ass neighbors, that can be a problem. If you live somewhere like I do, unless you're cooking meth or something, it doesn't matter. They may not like it, but there's absolutely nothing they can do about it. There's literally no one for them to call. If they call the sheriff, if it's not a criminal matter, he doesn't care. Well, his lawn is really unkempt, and there's bees flying around everywhere and all, and the sheriff's like, don't call us. But if you live somewhere where the Department of Making You Sad can show up, this is the problem with is the neighbor a bother versus can the neighbor become a bother. What if the neighbor moves and a new neighbor comes that doesn't like the way things are? Do they have a mechanism by which to suppress the freedom that you've moved there for? It's very important that you know that and double verify things. We've had people on the show that we've supported in their efforts that have made the mistake of they called the city, the county, whatever, and said, is it legal to have goats here? And the person said, yes, it is. They said, okay, and they bought the property, and they moved there, and they put goats there, and it turned out, no, it wasn't. And the person that told them it was doesn't remember the phone call, can't help them, no one knows what the hell they're talking, that type of thing. Verify and double verify the things that are really important to you. What are the restrictions? And by God, I'll have to say it, HOAs, no. No HOAs. If you want a homestead, you don't want an HOA. Because that is another layer of government. The only exception to that would be a community built around homesteading that has an HOA to make sure that nobody bitches about homesteading. That would be about it. And I don't even think you really need that. It's actually still a risk. It still can be taken over by blue hairs and ruined. Right? So neighbors, can they be a bother? Are they going to be a bother? Generally speaking, if you move to an area and everybody seems to kind of be homesteading along already, you got it made. They're not going to be upset. You are fitting in to the community versus trying to change it. Because even though I hate HOAs, I do have no sympathy for the person that knows they want a homestead, knows they want chickens, knows they want a little potbelly pig running around, and buys a McMansion in the middle of an HOA and then bitches that they're not allowed to do it when they knew they couldn't do it when they got there. You have no more right to come in as an outsider and change the community than somebody has the right to come into your community and change your community as an outsider. So please do that due diligence first. And then opportunity. And the opportunities are many that we need to look at. For that day job, many of you are not going to be full-time farmers, homesteaders, etc. Most of you won't be. And so what is the opportunity to live and work in a place that you want to be? And I think that's one of the biggest things holding people back. They're waiting till they're done working. They're waiting till they retire. They're waiting till they save up enough to start their business. Go live where you can work. Even if you're not going to work, even if you run your own business or something like that. So then what's the opportunity for your spouse, your kids, etc.? What is the opportunity for social engagement? If you guys like to shop, there's nothing wrong with liking to go places or going to nice restaurants. You should find a place with the opportunity to live the lifestyle that you most want to live, and don't lie to yourself about what that is. If you're not a person that really wants to live a primitive offwoods lifestyle, you just like elements of it and you romanticize it, then build those elements into your life, but grow somewhere that makes sense for you. And those are the ways that I look at choosing a property. And I consider not just myself, I consider my wife, my kids, my grandkids now. That's important to do. What are those opportunities for them? And before we side hustle, so we're going to also talk about side hustle today, we should also talk about self-hustling. This is how we actually make the property a homestead. So many people, I hear them talking, I can see the danger of where they're headed. I'm going to get a homestead, and I'm going to do a pick-your-own orchard, and I'm going to raise pastured poultry and sell that at the farmer's market and do microgreens and sell them to a restaurant. Hold up. Hold up. Each one of those in of itself can be a full-time business that you have the potential to fail miserably at. Again, we're back to mastering one at a time. But the first thing that we should be doing is providing for us. Me, myself, I, and my family. So the first thing we want to do is grow what we can use or store and not much more. I got a lot of rhymes that just came to me when I was putting this together. But that's so fundamentally true. I see people, they go, they put a garden in, and they plant a shit ton of something that's uber productive, but they don't really eat it. Like radishes. I don't know how many radishes a person... Yes, they can be grown in 29 days, but if you don't like them, grow something else. Or people to grow massive quantities of something like sweet corn. I hope you have a plan for what to do with it all. I'm going to sell it. Are you sure? I mean, start out with that small, easy-to-manage garden. Build the shit out of the fertility and the shit out of the productivity. Produce everything you can from the square footage that you have and feed yourself. Start to make the property put food on your table and feed and nourish your family. You will never regret the decision to start with 4 or 5 or 10 raised beds that are just to feed you and your family. Go there first. Next, determine the local resources that you can hunt or gather. And don't create duplication of that. Where I used to live in Arkansas, I would have never planted a blackberry plant. I swear to God, I would never, because the whole mountain in the spring for about 4 weeks was covered in blackberries. If I would have planted anything, maybe I would have planted primocane blackberry that would produce a second crop in the fall when there were none on the mountain. But there was such an abundance of blackberry. I would have, in my home scenario, you couldn't have paid me to use a square foot of that intensively managed area for blackberries. They were free. You couldn't pay me to plant muscadine grapes. They grew all wild ones everywhere. So I wasn't going to grow those things when the mountain was growing. Persimmons, wild persimmons grew everywhere. Those are three things I was never going to grow. There was no need to. Now, I might actually, if I'm doing it for larger production regions or something, like maybe that actually is a good indicator. And maybe I do want to plant persimmons because this is a persimmon growing area. But for the feeding myself and my family, which was at the time me and Dorothy, there was no need to grow those things. We could grow other things. Fishing. Right? Hunting and gathering. Determine those resources and develop a lifestyle that fits you if you like to do those things. If you don't want to do that stuff, then don't do it. Next, develop a lifestyle that maximizes your life and minimizes your costs. One of the reasons couples get in fights, especially once they find this show or maybe Dave Ramsey's, is the one side of the couple listens finally to a voice of reason that is, you are killing yourself with debt. You will never be free. You will die with student debt being garnished from your Social Security check if you don't get your shit together and fix your life. And they run to their spouse and go, oh, we gotta stop spending money. We gotta stop spending money. And the spouse is like, oh, bullshit. I don't want my life screwed up. I like it this way. Right? So we don't want to do that. What we want to do is start focusing on what are the things that really will make our life better. I'll give you an example. I put a lot of effort into this property over the past 4 years, as many of you know. This morning, getting ready for this show, I walked around the property. I walked around roughly that 1 acre that I'm really spending my time and effort on, you know, right now. And I went from tree to tree, and I looked at blossoms. I looked at the ones that were just beginning to bud out, the ones that were just beginning to leaf out, the ones that already had fruit set, and I walked by this autumn olive that I have a photo of in today's show notes, and that honeysuckle kind of jasmine perfume smell that those things have, that hit me. Taking that walk cost me nothing. It cost me money to build that, but now it feeds me. We're done. I mean, the cost of putting all this in, after this one season in food production alone, we're done. It's all upside from there. Not to mention the value of the property. Somebody comes here and is interested in buying a property, and you walk around, there's food everywhere. Not doesn't work for everybody. It works for enough people that the market average says it's done, paid for itself. But that walk doesn't cost me anything. How much quality do you think that builds for me? Yesterday, I quit working for a little bit in the middle of the day. Wasn't done yet. Had to come back and finish. But I went outside because I saw my wife walking my granddaughter around. I took my granddaughter and I set her up on the ledge of my wood frame timber pond. It's full of the bluegills and sunfish in there. She loves fish. She loves to feed the little fish in my fish tank. She'd never seen those before. And I got some pellets out and I threw them. And those fish were just going like piranhas on it. And she's going, oh, wow, wow, yay. What's the quality of life value there? And what's the cost? A dime worth of fish food? And what comes out of that tank? Fish tacos. See, this is the way to think. Before we worried about side hustling, can we make money? How can we save money and replace expenses with activities and a lifestyle that makes us happy to not spend money? Not miserable not spending, because when I want something nice, if I have the money and I want it, I go get it. I am not an anti-things person. But we don't always need things, and we don't always need to go somewhere. And most people in this country spend more money on stuff that they don't have a week after they pay for it than stuff that they do have a week after they pay for it. They spend it on food. They spend it on $4 coffees. The hell do I need a $4 coffee for? I'm walking around with a cup of Captain Picard tea, Earl Grey hot, that I've just brewed up in my kitchen. And I'm smelling the jasmine-like odor of autumn olive in the morning and feeding fish with my granddaughter. I have no need. When I go somewhere, it is fully by choice, not out of some need to fill something. And every dollar you don't spend is as good or better than a dollar earned. Seriously. Especially if we take it and put it away somewhere, or we reinvest it to something that pays us back more. That is worth more than a dollar earned. Far more. Twice as much. If we earn a dollar and have to pay for something with it, then we traded our time for the thing. If we don't spend a dollar and we get something good anyway, you see the difference. Not to mention it's not taxed when we do it that way. Next, automate, automate, automate. One of the reasons I really caution people, especially after my experience with our duck business, of going really big and really wide with things, is it ends up marrying you to the property. It becomes almost as expensive for you to leave as it costs to go on the vacation part of the vacation. Like having someone take care of it, or business lost, or whatever. Or losses of animals, losses of plants, etc. So if we go slow, and we automate everything we can. Okay, I've got this done, it works really well. But I have to water this garden every day. Well, let's set timers up so I don't have to do that anymore. You know, back when I had a regular job, so to say, when I first started this show and I was driving, I liked watering the garden. I came home, I was ready to punch a hole in the wall. Yeah, I was ready. I legitimately was ready to punch a hole through the wall. Not in the right mindset to be with my wife. It's not fair to her. For me to come home after being on the road for 60 miles and dealing with ass clowns and dealing with, you know, business dinners and entertaining assholes I didn't really want to be around or whatever. So I came home, hey, kiss on the cheek, fake it for 10 seconds, grab a beer, go outside, turn the garden hose on, water the garden. And it was therapy. I also only had that, that was the only thing I had going on that property. I didn't have chickens to take care of. I didn't have an aquaponic system. So that was fine for that. Still would have made sense to automate it if we want to go on vacation. Because that way we can go on vacation, come back, and it's better than when we left. It actually seems like everything grew faster because we're not looking at it every 5 minutes to see if something grew new. So automate, automate, automate. When we get the ducks gone, I think we're down to like 30 ducks. We get the ducks gone. Well, we got rid of a lot of ducks to like, we still have 30. When we get the ducks gone, the little chickens are coming out of the aviary, and they're going into what was the duck holding area. And they will do all the composting and stuff like that. And I am going to put an automatic door on the chicken coop. And I will teach them at night, go to the coop. And the door will close. And in the morning, the door will open. I'm going to get a deer feeder. Moultrie, 6-foot deer feeder, pulls 350 pounds. I'm going to set it right in the middle of their holding area. I'm going to throw chicken food in it. And I'm going to set it, and two or three times, once we figure out what they eat and how long duration, it'll throw pellets, and they'll eat the pellets. Either that, or I'll do a big hopper feeder. I haven't decided how I want to do this yet, but it will be to the situation where, other than picking up eggs and bringing them compost, you could just not go there for a week, and they're not going to die. They're going to be fine. That also makes it, if we have to bug out, you can't bug out with all your chickens. You're not going to do it. I'm sorry. So if we have to bug out, you know, at any given point that if we bug out, they got at least a week that they're going to be okay. Automated watering, doors, etc., protected from predators. As long as while whatever we're bugging out from, if it doesn't hit here, and we hope it doesn't because we'd love to come back, then they're going to be okay. So automate, automate, automate. Next, go slow. I know I've kind of already said this throughout, but go slow. One or two projects at a time. Less done right is better than more done wrong. There's times where, you know, I have gone too far, and I'm like, I want to do this, and I end up having to spend a week that I thought I was going to have a lot of time to do new stuff, fixing stuff that broke, fixing stuff that went wrong. And every time I fix something that went wrong, I step back from it and go, okay, well, that's the patch. What's the prevention? You know, I got that way with the watering system this year. Hey, the patch is the pipe breaks, put in, you know, go out there, cut a piece out. How do I prevent the pipes from breaking when it freezes? I know, I'll shut the water off to the property and blow all the pipes out with an air compressor. Once the ducts are gone, you know, that the amount of the system that's blown clear in the winter is going to be much bigger and not have to be turned back on in between, you know, the nice temperatures and the cold temperatures. And I know some of you guys up north, well, but I saw barrier pipes. Doesn't work here. Sorry, guys. 4 inches of soil on a lot of the property. I'd need a rock trencher to bury pipe, and I can't afford it. So those types of things. One or two projects at a time and get them buckled down solid to where it literally takes 5 minutes of your time to maintain that system. If it's a garden, that 5 minutes is, there's a weed. That weed's not big enough to feed the chickens yet. There's a piece of something to eat. There's something to eat. There's something to eat. There's a little space in the mulch there. There's a little mulch on it. Okay, done. When you get to there with your garden, now do something else. When you get to, okay, I'm going to go over the chickens with the weeds from the garden, and there's the chickens in there. That goes in there. Here's the compost from inside for the chickens. There's my eggs. The feeder's good. Water's good. Birds are happy. Buy chickens. Now we do something else. You come out at night to check on everything. Chickens are in the chicken house. Door closed itself. Everything's good. Raccoons can't get in and kill them. Solid. Okay. Now I'm ready to do something new. Now I'm going to do my aquaponic system. You get that aquaponic system where it's running, doesn't constantly mess up on you, you got it balanced, now you can make it a little bit bigger. If you take that approach, your life will be so much happier, and your spouse won't end up hating what you've talked them into. And you'll feel like everything I do produces a result that gives me something, that cuts my cost rather than increases my cost, that gives me more time versus takes more time, and that I enjoy. So once we do that, now we can look at side hustles. And I'm not saying we can't do some of this stuff concurrently, but like if we have that mindset of this is what I want my life to be like, then the side hustle fits in. One of the things I really try to tell people when it comes to side hustles is remember that we as a people, as preppers, as liberty-minded folks, we want to largely exist outside the system as much as possible. Everybody wants to talk about the advantages of building a corporation and using that for tax benefits and all. There is a place for agorism. And agorism, of course, is the absolute free market. The word, I believe, is from Greek, and it would be, the agora was just the marketplace. So it was just like the place that you went in the middle of town and you traded goods and services for money. And in most instances, there was no real oversight of that. People just did that. Who wouldn't stand for, you know, the government getting in the way of it? And of course, the government just wanted everything to be peaceful, so they had their means of taxation. They kind of left the agora alone. And they don't leave us alone today, do they? But there is a place for just understanding that what happens between you and your next-door neighbor is your business and nothing else. And I'll talk more about that as we go through. But just agorism is a good thing, in my opinion. Okay? And next, sometimes it's okay to lose money. Usually it isn't. So when's it okay to lose money? When the activity that you're doing, you would probably have to do anyway, and it creates a tax deduction, then it's okay to lose money. And every other time it's not. Or I guess the other one would be, well, I'm going to lose money in my first year of operations. Here's my forecasted plan to make things profitable by year two. You need to track your time and your expenses. And if an activity is not profitable, it's either a hobby or we don't do it. I'm not going to say we don't do it because maybe it's a hobby and maybe you like it. But there's actually a good case to be made for try to make your hobbies at least pay for themselves. You know, people ask me, well, what should I grow for fish in my aquaponics system if I want to, you know, get a lot of fish out of it? A really beautiful koi, and you should sell them to yuppies and use that money to buy fish. Because it's the most profitable tactic. The aquaponics system is not a fish production system. It is a vegetation productive system that is fish as a byproduct. If what you really want is protein in large quantities, then, you know, you grow a koi for 2 or 3 years and sell it for $150. That buys a lot of fish. Don't get it wrong. You know, we processed, I think, a good 40 tilapia this year. They're fantastic eating. Way better than the tilapia that come from the store, I'll tell you that. But as a whole, you get a lot more vegetative production out of there. So we need to make sure that we understand the profitability versus the hobby nature of what we're doing. And if we can make hobbies pay for themselves and break even, that's great. Especially if we do it as an agorist. All right? And again, if you're not sure what agorism is, that's your word of the day. Go look it up. Next, I think you should define the goal of your side hustle or hustles. And to me, there's a lot of goals once we get down to, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to put a metal shop in my garage and do metal fabrication. Right? But that's when we get into those individual. I'm talking about the bigger overriding goal. And the two big classes of side hustles are transitional side hustles and pure side hustles. What do I mean by that? The transitional side hustle, we just had somebody ask the question about the metal shop. And they're starting to do metal fabrication and things like that for people. I believe that's what it was. And in that instance, it may be that, okay, so I work my J-O-B for ABC services. And I have this metal shop. And what I want to do is build up my metal shop to where I can go down to ABC services and say, you know what, it's been great, it's been real fun. I appreciate the opportunity I've had here. I appreciate you giving me a livelihood, and I want to walk away under good graces. Here's my letter of resignation. I'm giving 2 weeks notice, and I bid you well, and I wish you well. And if there's anything I can do to smooth the transition over, I'll do that. And they say, okay, great. And then 2 weeks later, you're in Joe's metal shop in your property, and you've transitioned. That's why it's a transitional side hustle. The entire point was, we're going to trial it as a side hustle. If it works, we're going to grow it to the point where it's sufficient to know that by walking away, I can grow it to a full-time income, and now this is what I do. Okay? The pure side hustle is, this is a thing that I do that I like doing that also makes me some money. And I have no intention of this becoming a transitional side hustle. And it doesn't mean that one of those might not actually turn into that. Because sometimes when we do a lot of side hustles, all of a sudden you go, oh my God, this not only works, I love it, it's what I was born to do. And you still have to be careful. There is a terrible movie. A movie that made me want to go get a baseball bat and commit suicide by baseball bat. It was that bad. I was talking to watching by a girl that I was dating before I met Dorothy. And it was called Hope Floats. And my response after seeing this movie was, hope may float, but so does shit. But it had about 30 seconds of an incredibly insightful moment. This main character, dude, I could not tell you the name of anybody in this thing, was an incredible woodworker and cabinet maker. And this lady that he was kind of sweet on or whatever, I don't remember exactly how it worked, but anyway, she ends up at his property. She kind of always looked down at him like he had nothing going on. And she looks at like the cabinetry and the house and the beauty of it all. And she said, you did this? And he says, yeah. And she says, well, why don't you do this for other people? People would pay a lot of money for this. And he said, oh, that's great. You take something you love and turn it into what you do for money and destroy it. I think that can be true, but it doesn't have to be true. And we need to be mindful of that as we're figuring out what we're doing with our side hustles. My great uncles and grandparents' generations, they all had side hustles. Little things here and little things there. We'll talk about some of them. But they were never designed to be transitional side hustles. They were just, you know, this is a thing that I'm good at. And for really close friends, maybe I do it as a favor once in a while. But overall, like, I do this thing, and then people know I do that, and so they'll come to me for that, or I'll go to them and say, I could do this for you. And that generation was very entrepreneurial because they lived at a time when you had to be. You know, they lived through the Great Depression. They understood the value of what you knew and could do. So here's some stuff that I think about from discussions today on Zello and from memory of my family and all things put together. We actually had somebody ask this question, and I'm not even sure if it was the same person I heard on Zello today, but what to do with a whole bunch of super hot peppers. Like, you could do novelty and sell plants to people or harvest them and what have you. And the one guy that was on the air today said, I don't know how many ghost peppers or whatever they were that I got off of one plant this year, but I know that the last harvest was over 100. What would we do with a buttload of hot peppers? See, to me, what I would do is I would develop either a fermented pepper sauce, or I would develop a powder, which I think is an even better, and maybe multiple versions of it with different levels of heat. And I would store the raw materials, and I would market the unique nature of these things are grown or sourced and how and what they are and how I put them together in my own kitchen. I would sell it if necessary with protection under basically local cottage food laws, but I would primarily start out doing it as an agorist. And here's what I'm trying to say. Like, one of the things we need to do when we look at these pure side hustles is, well, how much money do I really need to be this worth doing? If you can make $50 a week on something, that's $200 a month. $200 a month invested, if that just becomes what you invest in your retirement account and you piss away the rest of your money, most Americans, if they started doing that in their early 20s, would retire multimillionaires from something that simple. And we don't need to make 50 off a side hustle. We have a few little things we do, and we can make $50 to $100 a week in the combination of them. And maybe sometimes that income's bursty. In other words, it's a little bit here and there throughout the year, and then there's maybe one big thing that we do. I knew a lady where I grew up. It's not on my list of things, but I'll throw it out as an example. She made the most incredible apple crumb cake in the world. It was absolutely to die for. It's not like a bundt cake with a hole in the middle and all. I can't even begin to tell you how good this was. And you only got it once a year because she only made it once a year, and she worked her ass off for about a week once a year making these cakes for everybody. We got two for free because we had a whole shitload of apples that fell off a tree. They weren't really good for much else. They were apples from the time when people would just throw an apple core out and maybe a tree grew and you didn't cut it down. And I would gather a bunch of these up and I would take them to her. And we get two apple cakes for free. She sold these things for $10 a cake. This is the 80s. $10 for a cake in the 80s was quite... But no one bitched. She sold every one she could make. Sometimes people would buy one and wrap it up really good and put it in the freezer just so you could taunt somebody with a piece of it later when they were all gone. I don't think the woman ever bought an apple in her life. She had enough people like us that brought her apples in exchange for a cake or two that she didn't have to buy apples. So her investment was her time and basically flour, sugar, and I guess probably, I don't know how the hell you make it. I never learned. That's just one example of a bursty source of income. And I'm sure that did a good thing for her. She wouldn't have worked that hard. She was an older lady. You could tell that it kind of wore her out that week, but she only did it once a year. And I promise you, she was doing it in an agorist model. I guarantee you. Again, look that word up if you don't know what it means. So with this hot pepper thing, we could be producing plants for people that want them, but we could also be producing a pepper powder, like a chili powder type thing. And I think actually bringing the heat way down and making it unique and different has a lot going on for it. And once we had a few different ways that we made it, we don't have to make a whole bunch of it up so it just sits there. We can make it up on demand. That would be another example of what we could do. And you're not going, unless you take it big, you know, Joe Blow's pepper powder or something like that, and you end up in grocery stores, you're not going to make a full-time income on something like that. But can you make a few $100 a year? Maybe. For what? Do you like doing it? Is it a lot of work? I mean, then maybe you don't do it. If you like doing it, it's not a lot of work, then maybe you do it, right? Everybody wants to sell eggs. I know a little bit about selling eggs. We went from being very profitable selling eggs to losing money selling eggs. Same price, same birds, same productivity. Tell you what happened. Dorothy no longer was running the business. And that was a big part of our decision. Dorothy went from, when we moved here, going, I don't have anything to do. I've worked my whole life. You know, at least when we were in Arkansas, we had an office away from the house. I went there and did my work with you and hung out there for a bit. And I had the mountains to walk and everything. So I you know, but even that, I was kind of bored. And now we're moving back here and I don't have anything to do. And I said, okay, well, what do you want to do? And we had gotten some chickens. She said, well, let's try selling the eggs. So we started selling chicken eggs. We ended up selling some duck eggs. Duck eggs were profitable. Chicken eggs were not. Chickens went out. Ducks came in. And I taught her. I designed a system. I taught her to run the system. And I built a business system. I showed her how to run that business system. And I backed off and said, it's yours. I don't want to do this. You do. And she was fantastic. If we lost a restaurant, in a day she had another restaurant. We didn't have a single egg go to waste. We weren't donating eggs to charity. We weren't boiling up eggs for dogs. I had 120 ducks, and I had to eat chicken eggs. I couldn't even afford to eat my own eggs because they were all sold. I'd get caught eating some duck eggs every once in a while. She'd yell at me. And then, ba-doom, grandchildren. And she wasn't running that business as an operational business anymore. Now, hey, I got to get her some help. I hire a young kid. He's an expense. She's not. Now, he's taking care of some of the grunt work, but he's not going to be out there getting us a new restaurant. He's not going to be out there hammering the whole customer list when we have a surplus. Because when we did have a surplus in the past, all she did was pick up her phone and start texting. And she'd go through 30, 40 people. And when she first started, she'd come to me and go, I'm a little worried. We got like 25 dozen eggs in the refrigerator right now that I don't have sold. And it's like, this last week you were screaming for supply. And then I'm like, well, go do your system. And she'd come back in like 15 minutes. They're all gone. It's just exciting, right? And she enjoyed it. But once she doesn't have time to do that anymore, it doesn't become profitable. And this is the thing with farm-based businesses. If you're going to scale them to size, they have to be run like operational businesses or you're not going to make money. So you're better off if you wanted to do something like that is then you have just enough to sell to four or five people that are consistently going to buy from you. A dozen or two eggs at a time. Now we can do this. And if you live in a rural area where everybody does it, it's much more difficult. So we have to think about it. So with livestock, egg business, etc., you got to actually run the numbers in advance, and you need to slowly scale into these things. And it is a challenge, and I'll tell you why. It's pretty easy to be small and sell 10 dozen eggs a month for $80 and cover your feed and what have you and manage that. That's actually pretty easy to do. It is not easy, but it's very doable to build a hardcore business on something like that and move 200 dozen a month. It's very difficult to be in the middle because you do not have enough supply to maintain a customer base in the middle. You either have a guaranteed, consistent few people, and if you lose one person and they don't buy a dozen, you got to find one person. Or that week, the dogs eat a dozen eggs. Right? I mean, that's easy to adjust to. When you're sitting in that middle, because we had losses where it pushed us back to the middle, it was very difficult to maintain the customer base. And I'll tell you, eggs are not going to make you a fortune. They have to be the core of a business with other products. So if you want to go farm business, you got to really think about it. So I think with the livestock and stuff, it is better to produce just enough for yourself, maybe less than you can use until you perfect your systems. And then grow just enough that everything you produce in excess of what you can use is gone. And if it's not gone, don't grow beyond that. Next, I talked about agorism, and I talked about what I remember of being a kid and seeing my grandparents and my great uncles and all their little side hustles and stuff. And what I came up with, one of my little rhymes for today, Granddaddy made shine and Buddy Shoemaker made wine. So I think Granddaddy made shine is pretty evident. I'll tell the Buddy Shoemaker stories for some of you that haven't heard in the past. Just down the road from me, there's a guy named Buddy Shoemaker. Buddy Shoemaker probably had more social capital than the chief of police and the mayor and the entire town council put together, along with the priests of the three biggest churches in the county. That's how much social capital Buddy Shoemaker had. And what did Buddy Shoemaker do? He made homemade wine. And I know when I say granddaddy makes shine, well, that's illegal and the revenuers and all, but I'll tell you what, Buddy Shoemaker's history of making wine went back before that little law they passed in the 1970s that made it okay. Way back. All right. And, for instance, we got some really nice wine from Buddy every year, about a gallon of it. And we would take a whole bunch of grapes off of our grapevines up and just give him the grapes, and he would give us the wine back. He made a little bit more than a gallon. And he did a lot of barter, and he did some sales. And this is all highly illegal, with quotes around it. Real quotes, not air quotes. But I'm just saying Buddy Shoemaker did this, and no one gave a damn. And Buddy Shoemaker didn't have a sign that said, wine for sale. And there was no Facebook, but I guarantee you, if he had been around when Facebook was around, he would not have been on a Facebook group selling his wine. Friends and family. Okay? And I'm going to tell you, some of his customers were things like the local police department. Just saying. And you got to think, when you're doing anything outside of the boundaries of legality, what the risk is and what the potential is, and you got to make your own decision about something. I'm just saying that these people did this. That's all I'm saying. And there's a path to legitimacy there if you want it to be in those worlds. And then there is you and your next-door neighbor. And barter, in many instances, the old phrase goes, barter is better. So if I make wine and my neighbor is a lot better at growing black Spanish grapes than I am, then I'm not sure that any law is violated if he gives me a whole bunch of black Spanish grapes and I make wine, which is totally legal, and then I take that wine and I give some of it back to him. I don't think that violates anybody's law. Now, I think there's some taxes that are supposed to be paid about that, but your word of the day is agorism. Right? Granddaddy made shine and Buddy Shoemaker made wine. And I know people doing those things right now as side hustles, and they're not going to retire on it. But again, if we start breaking the numbers down, it's not that you can't. It's probably not the way you would expect. If you're going to grow crops, grow something that's a specialty crop. When I was in Hot Springs, Arkansas, they had a little rinky-dink farmer's market. And I always wanted, you know, I love farmer's markets. So I go down to farmer's market. And 80% of the people there had a table full of cucumbers, tomatoes, and peppers. And they never sold any. Do you know why? Because everybody that cared enough about health and good quality food and all, I'm not going to say they didn't sell any. But, I mean, you'd see them at the end of the day with still a table full of shit. I'll put it that way. But everybody that really cared, it's a great climate for growing things, had a garden and grew peppers, tomatoes, and cucumbers. So they didn't go to the farmer's market for the stuff that they easily were producing themselves. The guy that did the best there, and I bought quite a few chickens off, was a guy that did pastured chickens. He also did rabbits, but because of the law, you had to go to his farm to pick the rabbits up. He couldn't sell them at the farmer's market. So we really need to, you know, kind of think about how we're doing things. So examples of specialty crops would be things like microgreens. And there's a lot of people in this audience. They have gotten big into the microgreens. You know, John Dowie has Dowie Farms. He's got a place he rents now. He produces a shit ton of microgreens. And he has restaurant supply places, restaurants all the places he sells direct to. And he's brought in other product lines and stuff. And he's making a go of it like that. And you can do that. But what if you came up with a really great microgreen blend for a salad and you just perfected it for yourself? And, you know, that kind of would change through the seasons, what would be best for different seasons. And you just spent a year perfecting your method just to grow your own food with microgreens to produce food for you in a couple weeks or less. And once you had that schedule down, and you had taken some time and gotten to know people in your community, you put together a couple clamshells and went to people and said, hey, try this as a salad, try this on a burger, etc. And then you got, I don't know, 10 people that you make $5 off every 2 weeks. That's $50. I didn't say $5 in revenue, I said $5 you made, so that's profit. That's a side hustle. That's $100 a month. A lot of people can use $100 a month to get out of debt. A lot of people use $100 a month to invest. A lot of people could just take that $100 a month, put it in a jar, and be better off. And that's one little side hustle. And if you do it the way I just described it, you can grow as you gain customers, and you can reach a point where you go, this is starting to be like work. I don't want to do anymore, and you stop. Or you grow beyond it. It's up to you when you get to that point. But you can get to a point where it's probably where you're not doing that much more work than you were for yourself, but now it's paying for itself, and eventually it starts to make a profit. These are all the non-transitional side hustles that we're talking about here. Vacation cabins. I think if you have a big enough property and a cool enough property, vacation cabins is probably the number one thing you can do as a side hustle. And there's a couple reasons I love this idea. Number one, as long as it's actually a cabin, and people, like, they go out there and they stay out there and that's what they do, and there's a trail there and a pond there and blah, 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 you don't have to do much. You can even hire someone locally to do the housekeeping shit when they leave and build that into the cost. So you don't even have to do that. Additionally, what do I always say? When we make an improvement, it should create an exit strategy. There is no world in which you buy a nice little place, 20, 30 acres, and ponds and stuff like that, and you put a couple little vacation rentals in there, and you have a track record of successful rental of them, the value of the property does not increase more than the cost of putting those cabins in unless you did it in a really stupid way. So there's an underlying asset value increase there. And it's a perfect lifestyle business. Let's say you want to go away for a month. You just don't rent the cabins for that month. And the way you do this is that you put in one tiny house cabin, call it whatever you want to, and when you start having to turn people down because you got two people trying to do it at the same time, and not just once, multiple occurrences, now build another one. And you build it as big as you want to the point where now it's starting to be like work. I don't want to do it anymore. And I think function stacking multiple layers of these types of side hustles is a lot easier and more doable for many people than trying to make any one of them into something huge. Many of them will be seasonal. Next one, self-fertility. You know, you build that garden, build an awesome composting system, start making compost teas, worm teas, whatever, and make your garden blow and go for a year or two, and then show everybody what you're doing. And they say, well, how do you do that? Well, you know, I can sell you some of this humic acid, and you use that, and you can use a little bit of this compost tea and some of my worm tea, and here's some comfrey, and, you know, basically sell fertility to other people. Most people that want a garden don't know how to do this stuff. Or they don't have the time to do this stuff. If you've built a lifestyle where you have the time, then, again, it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to be the next Howard Garrett with Garrett juice. All you need is a half a dozen regular customers for this, and a half a dozen for that. And you get to be known, and you start getting people to refer you. And when you get to a point where you don't want to do anymore, then you get to use the most powerful word in sales and marketing. No. And what happens is the person that you already have will not leave. Your customer will not leave. If I leave, he's going to take someone else. I got to get in the back of the line. I'm never going to get back in. And if you do lose somebody, there's somebody waiting for the opportunity to become your customer. This is all in how you handle and market yourself. But definitely selling fertility is an option. How about plant propagation? We've done a lot on that. But to me, the ability to propagate plants and sell them is like the ability to print money. And again, you can build a nursery, or you can let people sample goji berries. And when they go, wow, those are really good, you can say, well, I sell plants for $15 a plant, or you can buy them in the catalog for $25. Were they hard to grow? No. Here's a little bit of fertility to go with it. Put this on it. That's $10. See, this is the problem. People try to make everything complicated. I guarantee you that there's probably a market, if you wanted to, just making sweet potato slips every year. If you get really good at it first, do it for yourself. All these things, you should do them for yourself and get good at them. What about workshops? First of all, not as easy as everybody thinks. But you can do workshops if there's enough people there. And so this is about location. Always got to go back to location. If there's not enough of a market, or everybody, if you move to the backwoods of West Virginia and you think you're going to do a workshop on how to take care of pigs, you're going to have a hard time putting butts in seats. Even with the reach that I have and the workshops we do here and selling them out every year in a couple hours, I'll tell you one of the reasons we're able to do that is not just because of the size of the community and the market that I've created. It's because you can get on an airplane from anywhere in the damn country and get to DFW Airport in one connection or less, and then in 30 minutes you're here. And if you want to do something else while you're here, there's a great big metroplex south of here that you can go do other stuff in. And there's enough of a market here that 25% of it that sells out is local people. And when I say local, I mean a three-hour drive or less. Now, if you are in the middle of the mountains in Montana where Paul Wheaton is, selling out a workshop, no matter how big your empire is harder to do. And I think there's people that could probably do a pretty good little side hustle, run four or five workshops a year that are how to make compost, how to grow rabbits, what have you. $25-$50 a head. The more you provide, the more you have to charge. I always feed people. When you feed people, you got to charge more money. Our biggest budget is feeding people and the staff to feed people. You know, that's our biggest budget items when we do most of these workshops. Maybe flying somebody in if there's someone special we want to bring in, but most of it's food and staff. And the majority of what the staff does is make sure people eat well. Because I've determined when you feed people well, they're happy even when some stuff goes wrong. But probably the next biggest budget item in our workshops is porta-johns. In the past, we've done some with heavy equipment. All we've had equipment, somebody to run the equipment, stuff like that. But in general, that's our big expenses now. So workshops, I think, can be useful. But I think workshops have to be run either as a community outreach, which is mainly what we do, or for a specific profit. People that think they're running workshops and get shit done, you do, but you end up putting a lot of work into fixing things that get done wrong by students. Because you can't get in somebody's face like they're an employee when they paid you to be there. So you have to use some temperance with that. Crafting. I think crafting's great. I see people building all kinds of stuff out of fence wood and stuff like that. That's all great, but build what you can sell and enough to have enough inventory to demonstrate what you can do so that you can sell. Because I've seen people, like, their whole damn workshop is stacked with shit they've built and they have no market. You know, get it into some craft stores or something like that. Build a few things and see if people are interested in it. Develop a sales channel. Again, you don't have to have a lot of business. The problem with, like, the craft style business is it's not a consumable. So if I sell you a chair or a set of chairs, you're probably not coming back for more. Or if you do, you're not coming back for that. You're not going to come back weekly or monthly as a customer unless you're a distributor for me, a storefront, something like that. So that's the limitation there with crafts and kind of doing the Agoras friends and family thing. Unless you can get enough referrals to where somebody's like, I've been looking for this something here. Oh, I know a guy. If you can become that guy, then you can do a lot with it. I've seen people do well just doing around here. The one guy, all he does is a game called Cornhole, which is basically these big bean bags that are full of the shell corn, and there's two big boards, and you throw them and try to get them in a hole. And he does them at all the different colleges and stuff like that, painted up with the mascots and all, which I'm sure is highly trademark infringement, but I'm telling you, he's not selling them in stores. I'll just put it to you that way. And you're like, oh man, I wish I could get one for Texas Tech. I know a guy. That type of thing can be successful as well with crafting. And then bees. So everybody wants to go into bees, and I'm going to sell honey. My bee mentor, a guy named Jason, he's a paramedic full-time, and he does bees. He makes quite a bit of money doing bees. I'll tell you where he makes the majority of his money in bees. Removals. People call him up, I got bees in my attic. Okay, that's going to be at least $500. It might be more. Want to look at it, I'll let you know. Well, I'm not paying that. Well, I'm not coming. Click. But he does removals, especially this time of year when swarming starts, constantly. And he's going to charge a significant amount of money if it's just a big clump of bees in a tree and you're going to go shake them into a bucket. Now you can sell the bugs. Or you can put them into a hive, divide it, and sell two nukes. But he makes the most of his money off of removals. Next place he makes money, pollination. He's big enough. He has like an organic cotton farm. They need bees to do the pollinating. You take 50, 80, whatever it is, hives out to the cotton farm, and the bees do the pollination, and then they come back. Okay? That's number two income source. And then he does sell honey. The honey is a byproduct of the pollination business. And he's a beekeeper that doesn't like honey. And I switched him on to making mead. And he makes mead, and you know what he does? He buys honey to make mead. Because it's worth more to him to sell that honey for a profit than it is to use it to make his own mead. Interesting, isn't it? Now, I know another guy. Jason's running that bee business like a full-time business, and his basically plan is to work until he has retirement as a paramedic, and then do the bee business full-time. Right, so it's transitional side hustle that's being run almost full-time now. And being a paramedic, you know, you kind of do the four-day, three-day thing, stuff like that. So he has the time to be able to do that. Now, I know another guy, not transitional, pure side hustle with bees. His name's Chris. He's in Ohio. Chris's philosophy is you can make honey or you can make bees. Bees are more profitable and less work than making honey. So he gets some honey for his own use and all, but primarily what he does, he runs a whole bunch of hives. He splits them every year. He doesn't do that much work to maintain them. He lives in a climate where bees do really well without too much supplemental feed. He does feed them like he's supposed to. Doesn't care that much about the quality of honey except for a few hives he keeps for himself and for friends for major honey production. All he does is split hives and make bees. He'll split a hive into three hives and make two nukes out of it, plus the core hive, and build that hive back up to next year and then split it again. He makes a couple hundred nukes, which are basically like half a box of bees, every year. He sells them on one weekend. Puts out advertisements. We've got nukes for sale. It's going to be this weekend. Cash and carry only. Call and reserve. If you don't show up, I'm selling your bees to somebody else. Makes a significant, I'm not going to give away the guy's amount of money, but a significant amount of money to really actually work 2 days a week, 2 days a year. And he's done for the year. Now the bees are just being built back up. All I do is feed them, get them built back up in population high enough that next year I can split them again. That's it. And when he showed me his method of splitting, it was incredible. I got these three boxes, I come out, I take this box and I put it here, and I put that box there, and I put lids on them. That's it? Yep, that's all I do. Holy crap. That's the concept of the pure side hustle versus the killing yourself to run a part-time job business. And there's tons more than that we could do. But you know, there's no way I could go into what's every side hustle that you can come up with. Pick your own orchard? Great idea. Why don't you grow enough fruit to eat first, though? You know, I want to become a professional mead maker. Make your own mead. Grow enough to make. You're probably going to have to get into a situation, if you want to be a professional mead maker, get licensed and all that stuff, set up your meadery, that you're going to rely on somebody else for product. You probably are not going to do both. You might, but you're probably not going to. And you're probably better off doing one first, and then we can do both. And this is the mentality to come at this with. But I do want to speak here at the end to this concept. There's nothing wrong with a half acre with no side hustles at all. Well, we just go fishing on the weekends. We have a nice garden. We have a little flock of chickens. We have a little worm bin. We have a nice design zone 1, zone 2 system, and our life is better for it. And we spend less money, and we like being home more than we did before. It doesn't have to get as big as it did today with my descriptions of it. We have to determine what we want for ourselves. And a lot of times what I see where people make themselves miserable is they get romanticized into the ideas that other people want and convince themselves that that's what they want. You know what I want? I want a hunter-gatherer lifestyle on my own property. I want to go out and forage for my dinner. I love the fact that this year we're going to have like so much fruit. I'm not going to know what to do with all of it. I'm going to be making mead out of my brains, freezing it, making all kinds of stuff, giving some of it. I love that. It won't be enough to make money on. Don't even want to try. Don't care to because I won't have any next week. You know, come in the big glut. But what I look forward more to is having something available right now and all the way until it freezes to the ground again. And I know that we'll be eating something off of our property daily, if not at least every other day. If we don't do it daily, it's because I didn't feel like it that day. And that's okay. I think that's what's actually the best for the most people. You see, like, homesteading can be like a big thing that is a business built into it, or lots of side hustles built into it, or it can just be. And that's what we have to look at. What is the best thing for the most people? And do that first, because that'll probably work for you. And then you determine, do I want to grow beyond that? First, feed your family. First, provide for yourselves. Then worry about providing for others. Until you're producing a product that you're so in love with that you don't want it from anybody but yourself, work on that. Once you get there, then other people will probably only want it from you too. That doesn't mean you don't try a little thing along the way. If you can sell your surplus chicken eggs for $2 a dozen and that's all you can get for them, but they're all gone, you don't have to worry, then do it. Then do it. But you ain't going to make no money doing it that way. If you want to make money with an egg, you're going to be selling $8 a dozen and up. You can't do that? Don't try. Then just make enough for yourself. Make them some pickled eggs, sell them to your Uncle Joe, make some money on those. Stay away from Uncle Joe if you drink some beer with him, because it's going to drop bombs like you ain't ever heard. But other than that, just build something that works for you and your family. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Really appreciate the folks on Zello that helped me came up with the topic today. Want to remind you, one of the ways you can help support this show is by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. If you go to tspaz.com, you can help support the work that we do here simply by doing your online shopping there. You don't have to do anything else. Now, you'll see all the stuff that we review, and everything that I've reviewed is something that I use or I've checked out thoroughly. Today's one I don't really use. You guys won't hear me talk a lot about making bread. Bread is a high carbohydrate intake, and I try to keep my carbs down. When I let myself eat carbs for a few years, and I knew I shouldn't have, I put an awful lot of weight on, and I'm not going through ever having to take it off again. I'm just not. But this book, for those of you that do eat bread, that don't have that impairment or just don't care, is probably the best book on making bread that I've ever reviewed. And it is awesome. It's called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. And the concept is pretty simple. They give you a method of making dough. You make up your dough on Sunday, and each day during the week, you pull off a piece that's enough to make your bread for that day, and you throw it in the oven, and it takes about 5 minutes a day. It really is that easy. It really does work. There's a lot of great recipes and a lot of great technique in it. It's easy to learn, and everybody that I've heard back from that's tried this book loves it, and many people have it incorporated into their lives. If they're a daily or, you know, every other day bread eater, they love this because they have that fresh, real homemade bread every day. And I think back to, like, my grandma. Talk about side hustles. One of my grandmother's side hustles was bread baking. Now, she didn't do this. It was like a lot like the lady that made the apple cake I'm talking about. There are certain things in the Ukrainian world and certain times. And there's a bread called Paska bread, which is basically just homemade bread like she made all the time with a cross on it and an egg wash. And she would make a bunch of it around that one time, and people would buy the loaves of bread from her for like $5 a loaf. But I think about even when she was just making bread for the family, and like it being an all-day affair, and this being so much easier, it makes it more doable for people that have real regular lives that are trying to run their little homestead. So check it out again. It's called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. You can find it at tspaz.com, which just takes you to a section of the Survival Podcast website with all of my reviews available to you. With that, let's talk about our song of the day today. The song of the day today is called Only the Young by Journey. This song was originally recorded for Journey's 1983 album Frontiers, but it was pulled off at the last minute. The song was finally released as a single off the soundtrack to the movie Vision Quest, which is about a high school wrestler, if I remember right, which also included Madonna's Crazy for You. The more interesting part of the story of this song is through the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Journey hooked up with 16-year-old Kenny Skellick, who was suffering from cystic fibrosis, and played the song for him in his hospital room. Skellick, who was a huge Journey fan, died that night, leaving the band deeply affected. Quote, "As soon as I stepped out of the hospital room, I lost it," said Steve Perry. "Nurses had to take me to a room by myself." Inspired by Skellick, Journey used Only the Young as a concert opener throughout the Raised on Radio tour. It's a pretty interesting story. To me, this song, in some ways, though, is what it really says is, how have I put it in the past, that youth is wasted on the young. That young people don't know how great their opportunities are. Let me give you the lyrics. It's not actually a very long song lyrics-wise. Another night in any town, you can hear the thunder of their cry. Ahead of their time, they wonder why. In the shadows of a golden age, a generation waits for dawn. Brave carry on, bold and strong. Only the young can say they're free to fly away, sharing the same desires, burning like wildfire. They're seeing through the promises and all the lies they dare to tell. Is it heaven or hell? They know very well. Youth is wasted on the young. Only they are free to fly away. You think about, like, we talked about homesteading today, and when you were 18, you probably really could have done anything you wanted. It might not have come without sacrifice, but if you just want to pick up and go somewhere, I couldn't have because I was in the military, but once I got out, that's exactly where I was, and it was exactly what I did. I spent about 3-4 months on the Appalachian Trail. I moved here to Texas, just picked up and just came here and figured out what I want to do in my life. And I guess I could kind of do that today. I would end up with this business in a downspin or whatever, but I probably have more freedom than I have other than being that young at any time in my life. But, you know, when I was in my 30s raising my son and taking care of my wife and traveling all over the country with people I really didn't want to see, I didn't have that kind of freedom anymore. The youth have that freedom. And what it makes me think of is I think one of the reasons that our young people have so many problems today, they've been convinced that their life sucks. And I'm not talking about 90s teenager, you know, kind of like emo type, you know, life sucks or whatever. I'm talking about, like, they actually think, like, their future sucks. There's no real, like, it's just terrible. Like, this is a horrible time to be alive. The world's going to end. The polar bears are going to die. Blah, 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 blah. You're going to get shot in school, even though you're far more likely to get killed on a school bus than shot. I mean, it just, it's sad. And they've been convinced that there's no real future for them. They don't realize they're living at the time of their life when they are free to fly away, to live to their fullest and figure out what they really want. And we've done it to them. We've done it to them. That's what this song makes me think of. Because I kind of remember being 19, 20, 21, 22 years old and being in this kind of place and looking only forward with optimism. And I kind of feel like even when people were kind of down and out, of pretty much everybody around me looked that way. Lived that way, felt that way. And if you're working on that homestead dream we talked about today, that's how to get there. Look ahead. Look back for lessons and ahead for inspiration. The now, make the most of it. And don't let your youth be wasted on your youth if you're still young. With that, this has been Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. Help you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.